Chapter 5 The Storm, and What Came of It. It was nearly 3 weeks after their landing that the Dawn Treader was towed out of Narrowhaven Harbour. Very solemn farewells had been spoken, and a great crowd had assembled to see her departure. There had been cheers, and tears too, when Caspian made his last speech to the Lone Islanders, and parted from the Duke and his family. But as the ship, her purple sails still flapping idly, drew further from the shore, and the sound of Caspian's trumpet from the poop came fainter across the water, everyone became silent. Then she came into the wind. The sails swelled out. The tug cast off and began rowing back. The first real wave ran up under the Dawn Treader's prow, and she was a live ship again. The men off duty went below. Drinian took the first watch on the poop, and she turned her head eastward round the south of Avra. The next few days were delightful. Lucy thought she was the most fortunate girl in the world, as she woke each morning to see the reflections of the sunlit water dancing on the ceiling of her cabin, and looked round on all the nice new things she had got in the Lone Islands. Sea boots, and buskins, and coats, and jerkins, and scarves. And then she would go on deck and take a look from the forecastle at a sea which was a brighter blue each morning, and drink in an air that was a little warmer day by day. After that came breakfast, and such an appetite as one only has at sea. She spent a good deal of time sitting on the little bench in the stern, playing chess with Reepicheep. It was amusing to see him lifting the pieces, which were far too big for him, with both paws, and standing on tiptoe if he made a move near the centre of the board. He was a good player, and when he remembered what he was doing, he usually won. But every now and then Lucy won, because the mouse did something quite ridiculous, like sending a knight into the danger of a queen and castle combined. This happened because he had momentarily forgotten it was a game of chess, and was thinking of a real battle, and making the knight do what he would certainly have done in its place. For his mind was full of forlorn hopes, death or glory charges, and last stands. But this pleasant time did not last. There came an evening when Lucy, gazing idly astern at the long furrow or wake they were leaving behind them, saw a great rack of clouds building itself up in the west with amazing speed. Then a gap was torn in it, and a yellow sunset poured through the gap. All the waves behind them seemed to take on unusual shapes, and the sea was a drab or yellowish colour like dirty canvas. The air grew cold. The ship seemed to move uneasily as if she felt danger behind her. The sail would be flat and limp 1 minute, and wildly full the next. While she was noting these things and wondering at a sinister change which had come over the very noise of the wind, Drinian cried, "All hands on deck!" In a moment, everyone became frantically busy. The hatches were battened down, the galley fire was put out, men went aloft to reef the sail. Before they had finished, the storm struck them. It seemed to Lucy that a great valley in the sea opened just before their bows, and they rushed down into it, deeper down than she would have believed possible. A great grey hill of water, far higher than the mast, rushed to meet them. It looked like certain death, but they were tossed to the top of it. Then the ship seemed to spin round. A cataract of water poured over the deck. The poop and forecastle were like two islands, with a fierce sea between them. Up aloft, the sailors were lying out along the yard, desperately trying to get control of the sail. A broken rope stood out sideways in the wind, as straight and stiff as if it were a poker.
"Get below, ma'am!"
bawled Drinian. And Lucy, knowing that landsmen and landswomen are a nuisance to the crew, began to obey. It was not easy. The Dawn Treader was listing terribly to starboard, and the deck sloped like the roof of a house. She had to clamber round the top of the ladder, holding onto the rail, and then stand by while two men climbed up it, and then get down it as best she could.
It was as well she was already holding on tight, for at the foot of the ladder another wave roared across the deck up to her shoulders. She was already almost wet through with spray and rain, but this was colder. Then she made a dash for the cabin door, and got in and shut out for a moment the appalling sight of the speed with which they were rushing into the dark. But not, of course, the horrible confusion of creakings, groanings, snappings, clatterings, roarings, and boomings, which only sounded more alarming below than they had done on the poop. And all the next day, and all the next, it went on. It went on till one could hardly even remember a time before it had begun. And there always had to be three men at the tiller, and it was as much as three could do to keep any kind of a course. And there always had to be men at the pump, and there was hardly any rest for anyone, and nothing could be cooked, and nothing could be dried, and one man was lost overboard, and they never saw the sun. When it was over, Eustace made the following entry in his diary. September the 3rd. The first day for ages when I've been able to write. We have been driven before a hurricane for 13 days and nights. I know that because I kept a careful count, though the others all say it was only 12. Pleasant to be embarked on a dangerous voyage with people who can't even count, right? I've had a ghastly time. Up and down enormous waves, hour after hour, usually wet to the skin, and not even an attempt to give us proper meals. Needless to say, there's no wireless or even a rocket, so no chance of signalling anyone for help. It all proves what I keep on telling them. The madness of setting out in a rotten little tub like this. It would be bad enough even if one was with decent people, instead of fiends in human form. Caspian and Edmund are simply brutal to me. The night we lost our mast... There's only a stump left now. Though I was not at all well, they forced me to come on deck and work like a slave. Lucy shoved in her oar by saying that Reepy Cheep was longing to go, only he was too small. I wonder she doesn't see that everything that little beast does is all for the sake of showing off. Even at her age, she ought to have that amount of sense. Today the beastly boat is level, at last, and the sun's out. And we've all been jawing about what to do. We have food, enough. Pretty beastly stuff, most of it, to last for 16 days. The poultry were all washed overboard. Even if they hadn't been, the storm would have stopped them laying. The real trouble is water. Two casks seem to have got a leak knocked in them and are empty. Narnia inefficiency again. On short rations, half a pint a day each, we've got enough for 12 days. There's still lots of rum and wine, but even they realise that would only make them thirstier. If we could, of course, the sensible thing would be to turn west at once and make for the Lone Islands. But it took us 18 days to get where we are, running like mad with a gale behind us. Even if we got an east wind, it might take us far longer to get back. And at present there's no sign of an east wind. In fact, there's no wind at all. As for rowing back... It would take far too long, and Caspian says the men couldn't row on half a pint of water a day. I'm pretty sure this is wrong. I tried to explain that perspiration really cools people down, so the men would need less water if they were working. He didn't take any notice of this, which is always his way when he can't think of an answer. The others all voted for going on in the hope of finding land. I felt it my duty to point out that we didn't know there was any land ahead, and tried to get them to see the dangers of wishful thinking. Instead of producing a better plan, they had the cheek to ask me what I proposed. So I just explained, coolly and quietly, that I had been kidnapped and brought away on this idiotic voyage without my consent, and it was hardly my business to get them out of their scrape. September the 4th. Still becalmed, very short rations for dinner, and I got less than anyone. Caspian is very clever at helping and thinks I don't see. Lucy, for some reason, tried to make up to me by offering me some of hers, but that interfering prig Edmund wouldn't let her. pretty hot sun. Terribly thirsty all evening.
September the 5th.
Still becalmed and very hot. Feeling rotten all day, and sure I've got a temperature. Of course, they haven't the sense to keep a thermometer on board.
September the 6th.
A horrible day. Woke up in the night, knowing I was feverish and must have a drink of water. Any doctor would have said so. Heaven knows, I'm the last person to try and get any unfair advantage, but I never dreamed that this water rationing would be meant to apply to a sick man. In fact, I would have woken the others up and asked for some, only I thought it would be selfish to wake them. So I got up and took my cup and tiptoed out of the black hole we sleep in, taking great care not to disturb Caspian and Edmund. But they've been sleeping badly since the heat and the short water began. I always try to consider others, whether they're nice to me or not. I got out all right into the big room, if you can call it a room, where the rowing benches and the luggage are. The thing of water is at this end. All was going beautifully, but before I'd drawn a cupful, who should catch me but that little spy, Reap. I tried to explain that I was going on deck for a breath of air. The business about the water had nothing to do with him, and he asked me why I had a cup. He made such a noise that the whole ship was roused. They treated me scandalously. I asked, as I think anyone would have, why Reepicheep was sneaking about the water cask in the middle of the night. He said that, as he was too small to be of any use on deck, he did sentry over the water every night so that one more man could go to sleep. Now comes their rotten unfairness. They all believed him. Can you beat it? I had to apologize, or the dangerous little brute would have been at me with his sword. And then Caspian showed up in his true colours as a brutal tyrant, and said out loud, for everyone to hear, that anyone found stealing water in future would get 2 dozen. I didn't know what this meant, till Edmund explained it to me. It comes in the sort of books those Pevensey kids read. After this cowardly threat, Caspian changed his tune, and started being patronising, said he was sorry for me, and that everyone felt just as feverish as I did, and we must all make the best of it, etc., etc. Odious stuck-up prig. Stayed in bed all day today. September the 7th. A little wind today, but still from the west. Made a few miles eastward, with part of the sail. Set on what Drinian calls the jury-mast. That means the bowsprit set upright and tied, or they call it lashed, to the stump of the real mast. Still terribly thirsty. September the 8th. Still sailing east. I stay in my bunk all day now, and see no one, except Lucy, till the two fiends come to bed. Lucy gives me a little of her water ration. She says girls don't get as thirsty as boys. I had often thought this, but it ought to be more generally known at sea. September the 9th. Land in sight. A very high mountain a long way off to the southeast. September the 10th. The mountain is bigger and clearer, but still a long way off. Gulls again today for the first time since I don't know how long. September the 11th. Caught some fish and had them for dinner. Dropped anchor at about 7 p.m. in 3 fathoms of water in a bay of this mountainous island. That idiot Caspian wouldn't let us go ashore because it was getting dark and he was afraid of savages and wild beasts. Extra water ration tonight. What awaited them on this island was going to concern Eustace more than anyone else. But it cannot be told in his words, because after September the 11th, he forgot about keeping his diary for a long time. When morning came, with a low grey sky, but very hot, the adventurers found they were in a bay, encircled by such cliffs and crags that it was like a Norwegian fjord. In front of them, at the head of the bay, There was some level land, heavily overgrown with trees, that appeared to be cedars, through which a rapid stream came out. Beyond that was a steep ascent, ending in a jagged ridge, and behind that a vague darkness of mountains, which ran into dull-coloured clouds, so that you could not see their tops. The nearer cliffs, at each side of the bay, were streaked here and there with lines of white, which everyone knew to be waterfalls, though at that distance they did not show any movement or make any noise. Indeed, the whole place was very silent, and the water of the bay as smooth as glass. It reflected every detail of the cliffs. The scene would have been pretty in a picture, but was rather oppressive in real life. It was not a country that welcomed visitors. The whole ship's company went ashore in two boatloads, and everyone drank and washed deliciously in the river and had a meal and a rest before Caspian sent four men back to keep the ship, and the day's work began. There was everything to be done. The casks must be brought ashore, and the faulty ones mended if possible, and all refilled. A tree, a pine if they could get it, must be felled and made into a new mast. Sails must be repaired. A hunting party organised to shoot any game the land might yield. Clothes to be washed and mended, and countless small breakages on board to be set right. For the Dawn Treader herself, and this was more obvious now that they saw her at a distance, could hardly be recognised as the same gallant ship which had left Narrowhaven. She looked a crippled, discoloured hulk, which anyone might have taken for a wreck. And her officers and crew were no better, lean, pale, red-eyed from lack of sleep, and dressed in rags. As Eustace lay under a tree and heard all these plans being discussed, his heart sank. Was there going to be no rest? It looked as if their first day on the longed-for land was going to be quite as hard work as a day at sea. Then a delightful idea occurred to him. Nobody was looking. They were all chattering about their ship as if they actually liked the beastly thing. Why shouldn't he simply slip away? He would take a stroll inland, find a cool, airy place up in the mountains, have a good long sleep, and not rejoin the others till the day's work was over. He felt it would do him good, but he would take great care to keep the bay and the ship in sight, so as to be sure of his way back. He wouldn't like to be left behind in this country. He at once put his plan into action. He rose quietly from his place and walked away among the trees, taking care to go slowly and in an aimless manner, so that anyone who saw him would think he was merely stretching his legs. He was surprised to find how quickly the noise of conversation died away behind him, and how very silent and warm and dark green the wood became. Soon he felt he could venture on a quicker and more determined stride. This soon brought him out of the wood. The ground began sloping steeply up in front of him. The grass was dry and slippery, but manageable if he used his hands as well as his feet, and though he panted and mopped his forehead a good deal, he plugged away steadily. This showed, by the way, that his new life, little as he suspected it, had already done him some good. The old Eustace, Harold and Alberta's Eustace, would have given up the climb after about 10 minutes. Slowly, and with several rests, he reached the ridge. Here he had expected to have a view into the heart of the island, but the clouds had now come lower and nearer, and a sea of fog was rolling to meet him. He sat down and looked back. He was now so high that the bay looked small beneath him, and miles of sea were visible. Then the fog from the mountains closed in all round him, thick but not cold, and he lay down and turned this way and that to find the most comfortable position to enjoy himself. But he didn't enjoy himself, or not for very long. He began, almost for the first time in his life, to feel lonely. At first this feeling grew very gradually, and then he began to worry about the time. There was not the slightest sound. Suddenly it occurred to him that he might have been lying there for hours. Perhaps the others had gone. Perhaps they had let him wander away on purpose, simply in order to leave him behind. He leapt up in a panic and began the descent. At first he tried to do it too quickly, slipped on the steep grass and slid for several feet. Then he thought this had carried him too far to the left, and as he came up he had seen precipices on that side. So he clambered up again, as near as he could guess, to the place he had started from, and began the descent afresh, bearing to his right. After that things seemed to be going better. He went very cautiously, but he could not see more than a yard ahead, and there was still perfect silence all around him. It is very unpleasant to have to go cautiously when there is a voice inside you saying all the time, "Hurry, hurry, hurry!" For every moment the terrible idea of being left behind grew stronger. If he had understood Caspian and the Pevenses at all, he would have known, of course, that there was not the least chance of their doing any such thing. But he had persuaded himself that they were all fiends in human form. "At last," said Eustace, as he came slithering down a slide of loose stones, "scree," they call it, and found himself on the level. "And now, where are those trees? There is something dark ahead. Why, I do believe the fog is clearing." It was. The light increased every moment and made him blink. The fog lifted. He was in an utterly unknown valley, and the sea was nowhere in sight.